más que nada la que lava tiene que separarla.
What exactly happens to your laundry bag when it arrives at the laundromat? Laundry workers in Manhattan demand to be paid the city's $15 an hour minimum wage and the end of abuse at the hands of their employers.
We took up a whole battle to insist that the hospital provide us with scrubs that could be laundered at a commercial facility rather than...
Frontline healthcare workers are fighting for PPE and suffering retaliation. We talked to a Minnesota nurse who was fired when he challenged United Healthcare about having to possibly take coronavirus-infected scrubs to wash at home.
They are not the ones who can socially distance. They're not the ones who are going to be able to quarantine and isolate when they get a call and say, okay, you were exposed.
We'll also hear from doctors on the front lines of the fight against COVID in African-American communities hard hit by the health and economic impacts of the pandemic.
I'm urging my colleagues in Congress to stand up for the American people, to stand up for our freedoms, and pass this critical legislation now.
And the fight to defend journalist Julian Assange and whistleblower Edward Snowden continues. We will hear from Tulsi Gabbard, who has introduced a congressional resolution that calls for charges against them to be dropped. This and more in this week's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. In spite of growing nativism, the U.S. economy remains as dependent on immigrant labor as ever. In fact, in the post-Civil Rights Movement era, immigrants from Latin America, and Mexico in particular, have come to replace Black Americans as the country's super-exploited working class. There's no more dramatic example than that of the washerwomen. Once upon a time, these super-exploited workers were Black American women. Today, Mexican women do this unforgiving labor in New York City and across the country.
Yo soy de Mexico.
I came here to this nation for better opportunities for me and my family.
I'm from the state of Guerrero. I wanted to help my grandparents because one of them was very ill. I also wanted to continue my education.
Yo soy de Mexico.
I came with my husband and my two oldest children because I wanted a better life.
I'm from the state of Morelos, and I came to give my children a better future.
I came here to give my children a better future.
My name is Jacqueline Batista. I came hoping to give the family we leave behind in Mexico a much better future.
Can you give us a sense of how many workers there are, not only at this workplace, but across the city?
There must be many thousands. I understand that there are about 3,000 registered laundries with the Consumer Department in New York. If each laundry has two or three workers, there are laundries that have 10, 12. We are talking about 15 or 20,000 workers in New York City.
And that was Mao Magarias of the Laundry Worker Center in New York City. So, what exactly happens to your laundry bag when it arrives at the laundromat? Can you tell the listening audience what this work entails for the women who work the laundries? Because we deposit clothes, but we know very little about conditions there.
Más que nada, la que lava tiene que separarla.
The washer has to separate the clothes, but there are times when the clothes arrive very, very dirty with human excrement, human fluids, and there are just things one cannot stomach. Sometimes the smell is just too strong.
There's vomit in the clothes, clothes with excrement, with blood and needles. I got stuck with a needle once, and what did the manager tell me? Nothing happened to you.
No sabemos si esa aguja estaba infectada,
We don't know if the needle was infected. In the case of all workers, they have developed skeletal muscular disease, muscle aches, finger pain, back pain, a lot of stress, headache, eye irritation, skin irritation, because many of the clothes come with dust. They are contaminated possibly with something, so all these problems are very serious.
Trabajamos en un basement. No hay ventilación.
We work in a basement. There's no ventilation. The only entrance is the main entrance where the customers come in. It's winter now, but it feels hot in there. When it's summer, it feels like an inferno in there. The conditions are terrible in that place.
Pésimas y peligrosas. ¿Ya han habido incendios?
Terrible and dangerous. Have there been any fires yet?
Parece que una vez algo flamable traía la ropa de un costume.
Yes, we had two fires. On one occasion, there was something flammable in the clothing that lit a spark, and a flame hurled out of the machine. The most worrisome thing is that the extinguisher was nowhere to be found. We were running around looking for it, and the manager didn't know where it was either. Finally, one of us dealt with the fire. And that is such a small, enclosed place that the smoke was trapped there. The boss made us clean up, but smoke lingered.
El humo se queda ahí. Entonces, la señora hace que uno
and the lady forced us to work under those conditions. I feel that they should train the managers on how to handle an incident like that one.
Siento que ellos deben de contratar o darle prácticas a un manager para que se haga cargo de esos incidentes.
¿Cuáles son las condiciones materiales?
What do material conditions look like? How many hours do you work and how much do they pay you?
About
6 months ago, we were working almost 60 hours and no overtime, only $11 an hour. There has been discrimination by the owners.
I was always in a hurry to get the job done, but she only paid me $9 an hour, and the woman treats us terribly. And I always demanded that she pay me the minimum wage. And she'd get angry and tell me to work faster, that I was too slow. And finally, when I got paid, I didn't get my full pay. She would discount hours from my work. Once she took $30, and when I complained, she got angry.
In New York, Mexican migrants have one of the highest labor participation rates in the city. They are also disproportionately concentrated in low-wage jobs, a fact that drives the high rate of poverty among them, which stands at 34%, the highest in the city. That's because many of them are not paid New York's official minimum wage of $15 an hour. And in some cases, employers steal workers' wages as a form of intimidation. In late November, a small group of laundry workers at Wash Supply Laundromat in Manhattan demanded the city's $15 an hour minimum wage and the end to the abuse they suffer daily at the hands of their employers.
Talking to the owner gives me panic because he yells at us and calls us stupid.
Estúpidas. No.
Para los dueños, para los explotadores, el trabajador, la trabajadora, no es más que materia prima para la explotación. For the bosses, for the exploiters, for the capitalists, the worker is nothing but raw material for exploitation.
How did you manage to muster up the courage to launch this protest?
We
got tired of all the injustices and the respect that they didn't give us. We were afraid. It was nerve-wracking.
More than anything, I'm motivated because the owner wants us to work double time. But why should I work double time if the salary you pay me is not enough for me to lead a dignified life? All of this made me sick. Sometimes I got depressed. But then I said to myself, if I continue on this path, I'm not ever going to get out of this situation. I was also inspired by my coworkers because they said we're tired of so much abuse, of so many things they've done to us. So why don't we join forces and fight?
Lo que me motivó fueron mis compañeras porque dijeron, oh, Es que ya estamos cansadas de tanto abuso, de tantas cosas que nos han hecho. Entonces, ¿por qué no nos unimos? Unimos fuerzas entre todas.
Ahora sí, también me cansé de tantos abusos que ellos han hecho con nosotras. De que siempre,
we've always given the best of us, but nothing is ever perfect for them. Little by little, we started to give each other courage, and it took some time, but we finally launched this struggle. And we said it's time. There's no better time than now to raise our voices and let the owners know that we are not alone, and enough of so much abuse. During all these months, we've worked with them despite this pandemic, rain or shine, and you haven't recognized that sacrifice. But it's time that you recognize that without us, your business is nothing. My name is Yuriana. I have worked in this laundry for many years, and today I raise my voice along with my coworkers who are tired of being exploited day after day. We demand to be recognized as essential workers. They have not provided us with the safety equipment we need during this pandemic. They have discriminated against us. And on this day, we want to raise our voices for all those women who work in laundries in the city so that they will know that they are not alone, that there is a fight that they can also win, because this fight that we begin today is for each and every one of them. Thank you.
What is your demand and what do you want to achieve with your protest?
The first demand is that they pay us the minimum wage. Second, we want better conditions at work, that our rights be respected. We want the discrimination against us women to end, and we are asking that they recognize our union.
Would anyone like to add anything else? Justice. May justice be done. Special thanks to Marcos Maldonado for the production of this segment.
Matan a mi hermano africano, colgado de un árbol en Santiago. Matan musulmanes sin razón. Ah no, noticiero te mintió. Quizá no te contó, the story was never told. And here it on CNN, heard it going to the store. On el bodeguero se sala.
We now turn to labor struggles on university campuses. Sabina Wildman, National Organizing Director of United Students Against Sweatshops, addressed issues of student workers' rights and concerns in times of COVID on The Socialist Program with Brian Becker. We'll now air a part of their conversation.
As the coronavirus continues its rapid spread, students and universities have been some of the hardest hit. University workers and student workers are bearing the brunt of the crisis, while universities are still making money off of students and off of workers. Describe for our listeners what student workers are going through and what kind of organizing they're doing to fight back.
Back in the spring when, you know, COVID hit and campuses were continuing to be open, some of them were closing down, was when we started to launch our campaign called Student Worker Wednesdays, where we raised awareness that students are workers too. And oftentimes when people think about campus workers, they aren't thinking about student workers. And so that was a big part of our Student Worker Wednesdays, as well as, you know, highlighting specific student workers at different universities who are either essential workers or who maybe, like, after the campus closed down, were not able to receive their paychecks. And what's oftentimes happens is a lot of these jobs get contracted out. And so the university will, like, remove responsibility or blame and be like, you know, like, that's not us, that's Chartwell's, that's Sodexo, that's Aramark. So that was something that for sure came up. And so I think, and that also goes to tell more about just, like, our overwhelmingly increased, like, privatization of universities. But anyways, back in the spring, we started with a campaign against University of Alabama, where we pressured the university to pay the student workers. That was in April. But then since then, we've just launched a good amount of student worker campaigns, honestly. So the University of Illinois at Chicago, we had two really important campaigns there with RAs. During the pandemic is just the unique position that RAs or resident assistants are in. They get paid, or their compensation is through room and board. instead of like a paycheck, which means that they have more to lose from organizing because the fears are much higher, because they would literally get evicted the next day and lose their meal plan, which is typical, right, of like working class people in this country, that like if you don't have a job, you can't like pay your bills. They're already on the front lines, but then also just like what they have to lose is everything's very deeply tied to their ability to like survive. And so RAs are predominantly like working class students at the universities, and so they tend to need free housing to go to school. I was an RA. It's also a really difficult job doing room checks, like going into students' rooms, and sometimes they were not being given PPE. And then also just like not being told what's going on. That's just been a huge trend across all the universities, is where students, you know, don't know where the cases are, where the quarantine dorms are. You know, we even had to pressure universities to make public dashboards to share like what the number of COVID cases are. But anyways, at University of Illinois Chicago is where we actually had really big victories in the spring. The RAs were able to win full PPE kits with an N95 mask, gloves, hand sanitizer, tissue. They also, you know, got as much proper safety distancing protocol as possible, you know, little plexiglasses at the desks. And then they also got a huge, like, well, it was a big victory because typically hazard pay is a really big, you know, struggle that comes after winning PPE. And there's less precedent for that, but they won back pay through up until March 22nd with an additional $1 an hour of hazard pay. And then in the summer as well, some of the summer RAs weren't even receiving meal plans. So that was another big victory. At the University of Maryland, the RAs are having to deliver, you know, 6 students food in their dorms. And, you know, the 6 students, I mean, first of all, that's a frontline job that they were not initially asked to do. And so there's just been an increasing number of tasks that the student workers are being told to do. And there's just no opportunity to negotiate what those expectations are. You know, RAs, again, they're not unionized workers, very few. I think like one campus has unionized RAs. So a lot of our organizing has been just like urgent responding to these huge things that are really dangerous that they're being asked to do.
What you're describing is that the university setting is in fact a microcosm of our class society, and sort of the brutality and the polarization exists there as it exists everywhere. Can you just briefly describe what some of the ways that you've seen this play out?
So we've seen just across the board, service workers at universities getting massively laid off, as well as being, you know, some of the first workers being exposed to COVID. And so I would say, especially Black women workers, as we know, some of the majority of essential jobs are held by women workers, and workers who raise their voices up against these instances of racism, and they're the first ones to get laid off. And it's definitely not random, right? And so in general, we're seeing a lot of Black workers being laid off, and universities are claiming that there's a lack of funds. And that's just literally, that's wild, because the University of California, for this example, you know, they just hired a new president, Michael Drake, who used to be the president of Ohio State. And now he's getting paid $890,000. That's his base pay. So who knows? There's probably a little more. This was an increase of 56% from the last UC president's base salary, Napolitano. And so it just shows that if you're able to, and this was during the pandemic, he was hired and the chancellor's salary was increased. If during the pandemic, they're able to, you know, raise the chancellor's, the president's pay, while at the same time saying, you know, we have a lack of funds, we need to lay off these lowest paid workers. It's like, well, this doesn't add up. And on top of that, we've just seen that universities, you know, like the CSU, for example, which is a California State University, also doing massive layoffs. In a 2019 audit, they had over $1.5 billion made in profits. And those profits were directly made off of increased rising student tuition that leaves students totally crippled in student debt after graduating, as well as exploiting workers and just paying them literally scraps. And these campus workers cannot afford to make ends meet, to put food on the table, to pay rent.
We thank the Socialist Program with Brian Becker for sharing this interview with Sabina Wildman.
National Organizing Director of United Students Against Sweatshops. Frontline healthcare workers are fighting for PPE and suffering retaliation. Pacifica's Steve Seltzer has the following report.
Strikes are taking place all over the country for proper PPE for healthcare workers. In March of this year, Minnesota healthcare workers tried to fight for proper PPE. Minnesota Nurse Association NNU ER nurse and steward Cliff Wilming phoned management about these concerns.
Okay, so the date today is Saturday, March 21st. My name is Cliff Wilming. I'm an editor, we do the work, but I'm also a registered nurse at United Hospital in the ER. And we've had some issues with our chief nursing officer, our CNO, Janet Pestel, not approving us to have hospital scrubs. You'll hear people walking around upstairs. That's because I have a family. And so I'm just gonna go ahead and call Janet here to see, because basically, you know, our scrubs are bringing home, or potentially bringing home, virus. We want to wear the scrubs in the hospital and leave them there because we can. It happens all the time. So let's see if we can get a hold of Janet Pestel.
Hi, this is Janet.
Hi, Janet. This is Cliff Wilming. I'm one of the nurses in the ER.
Yes.
Yeah, and so I was calling because I was talking to some of our co-chairs, and I wanted to confirm something. You know, a lot of us are worried that we're bringing home this virus to our families through our scrub use. And it's in other Allina facilities, they are being given hospital issued scrubs so that that does not take place. Are we doing that at United, and what do we need to do in order to make that happen?
Cliff, that is not something we're doing Allina at this time.
Why is that?
It's not indicated through our infection control experts.
So you're saying that your infection control experts are unconcerned about frontline health staff bringing home the virus?
Who is this again, Cliff?
My name is Cliff Wilming. I'm a nurse in the ER.
Okay. Well, Cliff, I'm an incident command. I'm going to definitely share your concern. At this time, we are not having staff change out of into scrubs.
And again, that's because infectious disease is unconcerned. Did I get that correct?
Infection disease has stated that is not indicated at this time.
That was ER Minneapolis nurse Cliff Wilming, who called United Healthcare Management about the safety dangers of bringing their scrubs home to their families. Following this call, he was terminated, and also the management is trying to take away his nurse license. We talked further about these issues and how he was targeted.
You know, I was also identified by management as a lead voice, you know, in the fight for PPE. We took up a whole battle to insist that the hospital provide us with scrubs that could be laundered at a commercial facility rather than requiring us take our scrubs home to be washed at home and potentially infecting our families. And Minnesota OSHA actually, I think it was in April, wrote me an email and said that my case had been referred to the discrimination unit of Minnesota OSHA for possible retaliatory charges against United Hospital. It's interesting that this term general strike is being thrown around now, which, you know, I think is very refreshing to a lot of the workers. It's emboldening, and it starts to kind of ring a note with us to some extent. But why would we have a general strike for Joe Biden? I mean, why? If we're going to have a general strike, why wouldn't it be for the 13 million working women and men, you know, and certainly, you know, another entire element of this is like in the course of 2020, with the killing of George Floyd, you've got the entire new discussion about what racism, systemic racism is in the United States. I mean, if there is a moment for a general strike in the last 100 years, it is right now. And, you know, I don't have a whole lot of confidence that that's going to be led by the current union leadership. I think that's going to be led by the membership. You know, making connections with each other, having those conversations, building our sense of confidence, developing our networks, and something has got to give. I'm about 3/4 of a mile from the 3rd precinct that was sacked basically during the protests of against the killing of George Floyd here. You know, those protests went for weeks. here. There was the National Guard was here. There were Black Hawk helicopters flying over my house the whole time. The streets were very alive. The mood was rebellious and furious and also celebratory and triumphant. There was enormous sense of solidarity in a lot of those protests. And those moments hit the labor movement. And, you know, in Minnesota Nurses Association, it opened the door to a real conversation about, you know, what our response to racism is, how we identify it within the labor movement. It was led, you know, with nurses of color, really at the helm of it, driving those conversations and supported by a lot of white nurses. We wrote our own letter of solidarity from white nurses to the nurses of color in MNA that talked about racism as it's experienced on the job, talked about our role in developing solidarity, which is, of course, the essence of any labor union.
This is Steve Zeltzer reporting for Pacifica, and we've been hearing about the struggle of Minnesota nurse Cliff Wilming's fight for health and safety on the job.
Recently, many were shocked to hear that managers at a Tyson pork processing plant in Waterloo, Iowa, placed bets on how many workers in their plant would contract COVID-19. Ed Fallon, producer and host of the Iowa-based radio show The Fallon Forum, spoke with Joe Henry, Iowa Hispanic labor rights activist. Henry described workplace conditions that have enabled such incidents.
This is Ed Fallon from Des Moines, Iowa. We're speaking with Joe Henry, the national vice president with Forward Latino. It's disturbing news the other day that there were managers at a Tyson pork processing facility in Waterloo who were wagering on how many workers would come down with COVID. Do I have that right? That almost seems too bizarre to believe.
It is true, and it's not surprising. We know that racism has been part and parcel of the meatpacking industry for several decades now. So not only do we have the virus spreading in these plants, but we have racist behavior. And clearly, it seems to be a top-down type of thing with management. The exploitation of workers has been going on throughout this company, Tyson. And we know that 500,000 workers work in meatpacking across the country.
500,000.
It's a terrible situation. It needs to be taken on.
And this isn't the first COVID-related problem we've had with Tyson this year, and there are some other meatpacking plants as well, but we had managers who were failing to tell the public what was going on with infection rates among their workers, in part because of horrible working conditions. And as a result, we had a huge spike in the number of workers infected back in March and April.
Yes, here in Iowa, we've had 10 meatpacking workers die. Half of them have been from the Tyson plants in Iowa, and then the majority of those workers have been Latino. And when we look at what has happened nationally, over 40,000 of these workers have been infected. Over 200 have died across the country, probably more, but we don't know due to the lack of reporting from state governments such as Iowa that does not report to National OSHA or the CDC on those who have died at these facilities. We only find this out when it hits the local newspapers.
So how did we find out that these two it was the two managers, I believe, who were placing these bets?
Based upon what we have seen in the media and just hearing from what the attorneys have stated, this was noted at this facility with management when supervisors were being deposed. It was found out during depositions when they were asked what had happened at the plant. It seems to be in their own words that they did this, but I guess we're going to find out more once this goes to court.
Tyson's response has been to at least indicate dissatisfaction with their workers. I know they spoke out critically of the two managers.
They've distanced themselves, yes.
And then they went on to hire Eric Holder, the former
Attorney General
under Obama.
For the country.
Tyson has hired him.
Yeah, he comes with a law firm. So that's a good move. They have an independent investigation of that. But our sense of this, having worked with meatpacking workers over the last 5 years here in Iowa, this treatment of workers has been fueled by racist behavior, which has viewed workers as just part of the process of slaughtering meat, hogs, livestock. And we have filed complaints against other meatpacking plants here in Iowa, such as JBS and Smithfield. And we have received information from the workers, how they were treated in the workplace. And based upon that treatment, clearly racist behavior was part and parcel.
Have you noticed any improvement in working conditions as a result of those inquiries?
We've noticed some. Workers are being given face masks. They're being given temperature checks. But the speed of work still continues at a high pitch. Can you imagine wearing a mask and jogging for 8 hours? It's not going to work.
No.
So people are still getting sick. They're not getting the distance between workers required or suggested by OSHA in the CDC. So people are still dying. We had a meat packer who died 2 weeks ago at JBS in Marshalltown. Clearly, not enough is being done. We're not having mandatory checks of whether or not workers are infected on a regular basis. There's random testing that is being done. That is not enough. We feel that the virus is spreading within these facilities because there is really no ventilation in these plants for the way that they were built to process meat as quickly as possible. Everything is confined and workers are boxed in. It's dangerous.
So one concern, Joe, is the rumors of a proposal, again coming from the White House, to allow increased speed on the slaughterhouse line. I can't imagine how anybody would think that was a good idea.
I know. It's terrible to think that that would be allowed. The speed of work in that environment on the shop floor has always been too fast for workers. Lots of injuries, damages, carpal tunnel, workers not being permitted to take adequate time for rest. Now, in regards to that rumor, we will probably see a speed up of work before the next administration takes over. But if people can go to boycottmeat.com, they're going to be able to kind of review all the different things that we have done with environmentalists, worker rights groups, with animal rights activists, consumer groups.
Hey, Joe, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. If folks want to learn more about your work, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Boycottmeat.com. There is a consumer boycott against the corporate processing of what we call big meat. We're going to make sure through public pressure that the speed of work is reduced, the space between workers is provided, and safety is provided to these workers in the next administration, even though it is difficult with the way that these operations are set up.
All right, Joe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ed.
Joe Henry, the National Vice President with Forward Latino. This is Ed Fallon, reporting from Des Moines, Iowa for Pacifica Radio's COVID Race and Democracy.
Healthcare workers in Turkey are facing a repressive government and a privatized healthcare system. Coronavirus-related fatalities are on the rise as well. Mehmet Bayram is a journalist from Turkey. He writes for Sendika.org, an independent media outlet that has been shut down by the government more than 62 times.
As the widespread curfew for the pandemic takes effect in Turkey this weekend of December the 5th, 2020, nobody still understands or knows how the curfew will be implemented or for whom. Turkey frequently publishes new mandates on social protection against the spread of coronavirus. However, these are contradictory and simply do not make any sense. All prohibitions are geared towards keeping businesses open, but appearing to do something about the disease. Workers are not protected. Only the non-workers are forced to stay inside. Schools are in limbo as nobody still knows whether the schools will open, but Turkish Ministry of Education insists the education is in full swing, albeit remotely. However, how many students have computers, have access to the internet, or if the schools are prepared to give remote education are serious questions that the government is unable to answer. As with all other issues, Turkish administration jumps from one lie to the other, trying to persuade everyone that the country is a heaven on earth and is an envy to the world, especially to Europe. Turkey was not prepared for this virus, since it had shut down all its public health research and vaccine-producing offices because, as the government officials put it, they were unnecessary. This failed model is based on privatizing the healthcare system that puts profits first. The disease and the capitalist system's ignorance and indifference to it resulted in Turkey becoming the top country in Europe and the second country in the world with deaths related to COVID-19. However, the Turkish government has lied and continues to lie so much on the disease that, even after being forced to promise that they will publish the true figures, the numbers don't match. On the day the health ministry declared 160 total deaths, the city of Istanbul alone announced more than 225 deaths. The result of all these lies is the unbearable burden it puts on the shoulders of the healthcare workers and the unnecessary deaths that could have been prevented. According to the official claims, Turkey did not have any coronavirus cases even when the virus had spread all over the world. Turkey claims the first case had reached Turkey in the March of 2020. This is a lie, because Turkey never tested anybody to see if there were cases of the disease. By refusing to test anybody, Turkey could legitimately say it never encountered a COVID case. There were many reasons, all related to the profit motives of the capitalists, for the ruling classes and the government to deny the existence of the disease. First, Turkey was already in an economic crisis as a dependent client neocolonial country. Any disruption would impair the profits of the bosses more. Second, Turkey's economy is based on tourism. Any fall in the number of tourists visiting the country would have been catastrophic. Third, acknowledging the virus would mean curtailing the pilgrimage, and the flights of the Turkish Airlines, the government-owned airline, which is being used for much more shady missions than only passenger and cargo transportation. Erdogan's government is able to rule only with the support of its very religious base and the corrupt businessmen who rely on government contracts to be able to survive. The religious base is flown with the Turkish airline planes to Saudi Arabia for the religious pilgrimage, which is steady income for both the airline and for the pro-government middleman who arranged these trips. When some pilgrims were forced to quarantine in student dormitories, they attacked and fought the police guarding the facilities, and many escaped to reach every corner of the country to their homes and spread the disease there. The brutal Turkish police, known for its harsh attacks against women, the Kurds, or the healthcare workers, were left powerless as Erdogan's voter base, the infected pilgrims, spread the virus. Even after the acceptance of the disease, Erdogan's government minimized the pandemic. Many pro-government quack doctors, religious sect leaders, or appointed health officials started spreading fake information that the Turkish race was immune to this virus and that the virus only made the Asians sick and would not affect the Turks. As of this Saturday, December the 5th, 2020, there were 14,800 deaths from COVID-19 and 800,000 people infected with it. And these are only the numbers the Turkish government declares, which are completely unreliable. With the announcement that the pandemic had finally hit the country, the police, not the health officials, went on an emergency alert. The enemy wasn't the virus. The enemy were the doctors, health workers, and the independent media. When the pandemic hit the country, the Turkish police started scanning the newspapers, the TV broadcasts, and the social media for any news contradicting the official declarations in March of 2020. In May, the government media monitoring service issued a stark warning against commentary type of news broadcasts. The police cracked down on people's houses activists and detained them for distributing free masks. The detained activist was questioned in the smuggling division of the police. In the city of Urfa, the head of the Physicians Association was investigated by the police for giving out the number of cases in the hospitals. In the city of Gaziantep, when a union inspector found COVID-infected workers at a plant and asked for work stoppage, he was immediately detained and taken in for questioning. Healthcare workers have been resisting 12 to 16 hour workdays as deaths among their ranks rise, but the police attack every demonstration and prevent them from voicing their concerns. The vaccines Turkey has purchased from China will be administered by businesses run by pro-government religious sects who were given hundreds of millions of dollars for this task. All these religious sects are known for their corruption and mismanaging every project they are granted, as their only motive is profit. Corrupt government officials, religious sects, and businesses chasing profits have put the people of Turkey at tremendous risk as deaths rise.
Mehmet Bayram is a journalist from Turkey. He writes for Sendika.org. As the number of infected and deaths from COVID-19 rise at an alarming rate, healthcare advocates from four historically black colleges and universities, HBCUs, alongside the National Urban League, have formed a national initiative to coordinate and advocate equity for African Americans and other people of color. They call their project the Coalition of Blacks Against COVID. Joni Eisenberg, producer of To Heal DC from Pacifica Station WPFW, takes us to a press conference moderated by former DC Health Commissioner Dr. Reed Tuckson.
Dr. McDougal, as you sort of think about this pandemic marching through our community, what are your members seeing in terms of the hospitalizations? Are you beginning to sound the alarm on the availability of bed capacity and or workforce burnout?
There is an urgency in regards to meeting these problems with appropriate resources. And when we look at the national lack of leadership and a 50-state strategy that's uncoordinated, it affects our population the most. Our physicians and nurses and pharmacists, we're on the front line. So making it very critical that we not only participate in clinical trials, but we also have access to safe and effective vaccines that are developed.
Good. Dr. Dawson, let me ask you in terms of what, given what Dr. McDougal has said, what about nurses? You all are clearly on the front lines. What are your members telling you about not only their workload, but also their energy level? Are they getting burned out? And what about the risks that this society is asking them to take, especially people who are so self-absorbed that they decide that they're not going to wear a mask, but want your people to risk their lives to save them when they do get sick?
I think that is the most disheartening part of this. The nurses are going in, they're working not only long shift, 12 hours, 16 hours, but they're doing this 3 days in a row, maybe 2 days off, and they're right back into the trenches again. And they have to take care of people who are deliberately making decisions that they're not going to follow guidelines. And let's be real about this. We know that the scientists are telling us right. They started projecting that we're going to have a resurgence of this virus in the fall. And we're right in the midst of that. So we don't need to keep debating where's the truth coming from. We know where it's coming from. But for nurses, they're taking care of patients. They're having to have to participate in making decisions along with other medical personnel and executives in hospital. I was talking to a young nurse earlier this week who was sharing with me that their hospital had already started the protocol to make a decision as how they're going to determine which patients will be placed on a ventilator and which patients will not be given a ventilator based on things that we just heard about, pre-existing condition, the likelihood of they're going to survive. When I hear nurses talk about, we are having colds one after another again. And not only that, we are now having colds only for 6 minutes. So we may actually do three rounds of chest compression, 2 minutes, 2 minutes, and 2 minutes, and then they call it. We know as in the medical profession, We may go 30 minutes or an hour just to make sure a patient survives. So we have to take this serious. We have to look at not only preventing and teaching people how to do, wear their masks, wash their hands, but now we have to also deal with these things that are coming out in places where we know the majority of African-American are working. They're the employees in these meat factories. They're the employees in the big box stores. They're the employees in transportation. They're employees in restaurants. So as we want the economy to open up, we cannot say, give your life for the economy. We need to be trying to give them life, and then we can support the economy. That's why we're here today. We're here to be the voice for those who may not can speak loud enough. And we are here to make sure this goes right for our population, African-American and the Black communities and other brown communities.
Thank you for that. What are some of the reasons why we are seeing in African-American communities this increasing risk for this disease? And let me turn to Dr. Montgomery Rice as we start to think about what you mentioned earlier, the social determinants of disease.
So we've known for some time, Dr. Tuckson, that there's a disproportionate burden of the disease in African-American communities of hypertension, diabetes, and high blood pressure and heart disease. And we know that this is not necessarily because we are Black. It is really because of the many, many issues of lack of access to quality of care, lack of access to some of the novel interventions that have would decrease your burden of disease. Now, many people understand that this is a secondary to the impact of racism. And we know that this is ongoing. And so when we think about this disease, what we want to make sure that everyone understands that your race is not the risk factor. It is the fact that people who are burdened with this disease disproportionately are the people who are frontline workers, are essential health workers. They live in multi-generational homes. And so they are not the ones who can socially distance. They're not the ones who are going to be able to quarantine and isolate when they get a call and say, okay, you were exposed. Now you need to take 14 days off and wait in your house. And then somebody's going to deliver your groceries. That doesn't happen in our community. And so what we want people to understand, it is those social determinants that are influencing the outcomes.
You know, this is a very important point that you raise, in particular around these social determinants. So the guidance that we give in public health, and we're very clear about it, is that if you are infected, you need to be isolated. Our community, so often people live in multi-generational homes. Mm-hmm. There are many people who are sharing a single bathroom. Mm-hmm. There are people who have a difficult time because of food insecurity and those challenges. And so although we want people to be able to do the right thing, if we don't address these social determinants, I think your point is, Dr. Montgomery Rice, that moving from rhetoric to reality, from theory to practice, poses some significant challenges.
We just heard from former D.C. Health Commissioner Dr. Reed Tuckson, Dr. Leon McDougall, President of the National Medical Association, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, President of the Morehouse School of Medicine, Dr. Martha Dawson, President of the National Black Nursing Association, and Dr. Wayne Frederick, President of Howard University. Thanks to producers Joni Eisenberg and Lona Elias. Whatever the scientific truths about coronavirus, state measures to stop its spread can undoubtedly be used to justify state repression. Pacifica's Anne Garrison reports on two such cases in Africa.
During the third week of November, Ugandan military police arrested pop star and presidential challenger Bobby Wine, and the government alleged that his campaign rallies were violating state protocols for stopping the spread of coronavirus. As of December 5, the Coronavirus Worldometer reported that 206 Ugandans, 4 per million people, have died of COVID-19. On November 20, Al Jazeera reported that the police had shot dead 37 Bobby Wine supporters who were protesting Wine's arrest, and the New York Times reported that 600 had been arrested. The government seemed unconcerned that the virus might spread among those arrested and imprisoned. On November 24, Ghetto TV Uganda reported that fatalities had risen to 45 and published a video which they said evidenced police quote, firing into crowded slums, unquote. This week, police and military opened fire on Bobi Wine's campaign convoy in the Ugandan countryside. They struck and disabled the vehicle he was traveling in and injured several of his campaign colleagues. In a video shot by Wine's team, he can be heard asking the police, "Why are you trying to murder me?" It was then reported that Bobi Wine had suspended his campaign because of the violence, but shortly thereafter he reappeared campaigning in a helmet and bulletproof vest instead. In a campaign video, he reported that police had ordered hotels not to admit his team and that they had therefore slept in their vehicles on the street.
Yesterday, after being blocked from the road that goes through Hoima, which was a shorter route, we decided to drive the longer route. But by 9 o'clock, which is curfew time, we were here in Mijera, so we decided to get a hotel and sleep. Unfortunately, the DPC that you saw, one patient, Namara, stopped us, ordered all hotels not to host us. And we had no option but to sleep here on the street. Thank God, it is morning now, and we are planning to get on our journey to Changkwanzi.
And in Changkwanzi, the same story was repeated of pushing him into the villages. Here, the heavy deployment, which was meant to intimidate the people, was braved by the masses that gathered and went to both Changkwanzi and Chiboga before he proceeded to Bukuya and Kasanda, where he had his final rally.
That was Ugandan pop star and presidential candidate Bobi Wine and the narrator of his campaign videos. Earlier this year, in Ethiopia, the central government led by President Abiy Ahmed postponed this year's elections for another year because, he said, of the coronavirus. Dissidents said, however, that he had used the virus as an excuse to buy time to consolidate power. The TPLF, which lost its minority hold on power in 2018 in Ethiopia, held regional elections nevertheless and then attacked an Ethiopian army base in the Tigrayan region. Coronavirus Worldometer reported, again, on December 5, that 1,157 Ethiopians, 15 per million, have died of COVID-19. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Tulsi Gabbard and other members of Congress have introduced congressional resolutions to drop the charges against journalist Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, who exposed U.S. war crimes, and also against Edward Snowden, who blew the whistle on the National Security Agency's illegal spying on U.S. citizens. We now hear from Tulsi Gabbard.
Every single one of us as Americans are guaranteed basic fundamental rights and freedoms that are enshrined in our Constitution. But we cannot take these freedoms for granted. I've introduced legislation to stand up for and to protect brave whistleblowers who've come forward to expose illegal actions within our own government or egregious abuses of power, and to reform the Espionage Act to make sure that if a whistleblower is prosecuted under the Espionage Act, that they will have their fair day in court, something that is currently not allowable under the law as it stands today. So first, I introduced HRES 1162 with my colleague, Congressman Matt Gaetz, that very simply calls on our government to drop all charges against Edward Snowden for the actions that he took in the public interest to expose a mass government surveillance program on all Americans that violates our privacy and civil liberties and that courts deemed illegal more than once. I also introduced HRES 1175 with my colleague, Congressman Tom Massey, which calls for the same action, for the government to drop all charges against Julian Assange, who also acted in the public interest as he published information to expose lies and egregious abuses of power in our own government. Last but not least, I introduced a bill, HR 8452, to reform the Espionage Act. Daniel Ellsberg was the first person prosecuted under the 1917 Espionage Act for his act of bravery in releasing the Pentagon Papers to the Washington Post to publish classified documents that exposed the lies that were being told to the American people about what was really happening in the Vietnam War. Now, Snowden, Assange, and others are being prosecuted under this same Espionage Act. But as Daniel Ellsberg knows well, under current law, none of them are allowed to speak to the intent of their actions in court. My bill changes that. I'm urging my colleagues in Congress to stand up for the American people, to stand up for our freedoms, and pass this critical legislation now.
And that concludes this week's COVID Race and Democracy. This show was produced by Steve Seltzer and engineered by Polina Vasilyev. Our executive producers are Steve Seltzer, Akua Holt, and Polina Vasilyev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all other episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I've been your host, Johanna Fernandez. Thanks for listening.